This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Last week, President Barack Obama delivered on a promise he made. In his State of the Union address, he signed an executive order to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour for employees of federal contract companies.
A majority of Americans, not just Democrats, not just independents, but Republicans too, support raising the minimum wage. It's the right thing to do. So that's something Congress should keep in mind this year.
And he's pushing for Congress to pass a bill to match that minimum wage for all Americans. He believes it would lift millions of people out of poverty. Opponents foresee the opposite effect. They worry that raising the minimum wage would force companies to let go of employees and hire fewer in the future. Jeffrey Dorfman is a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Georgia, and he joins us now. Jeffrey Dorfman, welcome.
Hey, Frank. Thanks. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Bill Lester is a professor of city and regional planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. Bill Lester, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. Bill, let me stick with you. You've done extensive research on how to measure raising the minimum wage and what effects that would have on unemployment rates, because that seems to be the big problem. You pay people more in an industry where they're just trying to get by and they're going to lay people off. So you conducted your research. How did you do it and what did you find?
Sure. Thank you. And that's really the biggest issue, the biggest debate, both in the academic literature as well as in the public sphere, is what is the effect of minimum wage on jobs? And what we did in our study is we did essentially compared every time there was a state minimum wage increase from 1990 to 2006, whether it's state or federal increase. And we looked at employment and wages on counties that straddled a state border. So when there was a state minimum wage increase, we compared the counties on the state that got the increase to the counties right next door that did not. And we found is that wages go up. So we see that there's a treatment. The minimum wage is effective. But we saw that there was no disemployment effect, what the economists call a disemployment effect. Essentially, there was no statistical relationship on employment levels. That's the first paper, and that's the one that got a lot of recognition. It's with Aaron Dubé from UMass Amherst and Michael Reich. We've had a follow-up study. We actually looked at using that same research design, looking at kind of answering the question, well, why don't we see this? If textbook 101 economics shows that we should see a decrease, what's sort of one of the explanations? And in that, we looked at basically the rate of turnover, labor turnover in response to a minimum wage increase. So in that same research design, we saw the same wage increase, no employment level change, but a decrease in labor turnover. So that's one of the explanations.
A decrease in labor turnover in those places where the minimum wage was higher or overall?
Yes. So yeah. When the minimum wage went up, labor turnover went down significantly. And that was particularly focusing on both restaurant workers, which is an industry that uses a lot of minimum wage workers, but also for teenagers.
Well, Jeffrey Dorfman, what do you think of that? This is the sort of the central argument against raising the minimum wage. You're just going to lay people off, shorten their hours. It's not going to help them. You've heard Bill's research. Doesn't seem to have that effect. What do you think?
Actually, I don't think that's the central argument against raising the minimum wage. I mostly agree with Bill. I think I side with the economists who believe there is a negative employment effect, but that it's small. I think if you look through all the research, the consensus is that you lose some employment. It's not a big effect. It is particularly harmful to teenagers because that reduction in turnover that Bill is talking about means that people keep those jobs longer, which makes it harder for new teenagers to move in. But I would think the real argument against raising the minimum wage is it's a very inefficient anti-poverty measure, and it also imposes a good bit of the costs on poor people.
How so? Talk about that last part. How does it impose
the
cost?
Because businesses take this increase in their costs and raise their prices to pass on at least a percentage of that cost increase to their customers.
Well, I'm going to ask Bill about that in a second, but I want to get to the first part of your critique, and that is that it's not a very efficient way to lift people out of poverty. President Obama thought this is one good way to help people at the bottom. You say it's not very – doesn't work.
Well, no, it does work to lift people out of poverty, but a lot of the benefits also go to people who are not in poverty now. In fact, more people who make over $75,000 a year would have an increase in their household income from raising the minimum wage than would go to people who are currently living under the poverty line.
And why is that true?
Because most minimum wage workers aren't below the poverty line. Most of them are teenagers or single people with other earners in their family. So there's only about 26% of minimum wage households are actually people with kids at all. So you're in kind of a small universe there. And then within that, lots of them are making well over the poverty line.
All right. Bill Lester, start with that one. How do you feel about that?
Sure. Well, I think it's important when we talk about this current minimum wage increase that's on the table to use the right figures. I believe the figures that Mr. Dorfman are quoting are from who's currently earning $7.25. Well, there's two things there. First, 21 states already have a minimum wage above that, and so a large portion of the country wouldn't be counted in those figures. But if you look at the figures published by the Council of Economic Advisors using the most recent data, when we're talking about who, you know, going to $10.10 an hour and a slight ripple effect above that, that's 28 million workers that will see an increase in wages. That's about, right, from my calculation, 18.1% of the civilian labor force. And the figures he's quoting about living in a family that's 75,000 or more is just not true when you look at the current thing that's
actually
on the table. 46% are in households that earn less than $35,000 a year. 53% are over age 30. And 55% are women. So I think what the current proposal would affect a much larger swath of the population.
Well, Jeffrey, let me ask you about that. There are an increasing number, particularly after 2008. The companies have been doing better, but on the street, it's not so good. And we're seeing more and more people who are now heads of households having to work at those minimum wage jobs than we used to see. So the traditional kid just in high school trying to get through, that proportion is changing. It does seem that the figures suggest more people in poverty would be helped. Do you disagree?
I do, because actually I'm using the exact same numbers that Bill just quoted. So I'm not using from a different source. I'm, in fact, taking all my numbers from the exact same White House briefing. It is true only 12% of the affected people are teenagers, but still another 44% are unmarried with no kids. So a single person earning the minimum wage at a full-time job is not in poverty. They're above the poverty line. 18% are married with no kids. If they're each working a minimum wage job, which is not the case, in most cases, one of them has an above minimum wage job, they would be above the poverty line. There's only 26%, according to the White House's own numbers, that are households with kids. And 46% of the benefits, according to the White House, go to households under $35,000 per year in income. So if you take 46% of 26%, now you're down to about 12%.
Well, but that does
and
sound
in fact,
yeah, but there are 26% of the folks who are below the poverty level. That's going to help a lot of people, right?
Yeah, you would probably help 2 to 3 million households that are below the poverty line if you do this. But you're also going to give benefits to another 25 million households that are currently above the poverty line. So I would suggest if poverty is what we're trying to alleviate, it would make a lot more sense to raise the earned income tax credit.
Well, let me ask you about that, Bill, because I think that gets at 2 points. One that Jeffrey made earlier, which is that companies may not lay people off in big numbers and they may not cut back on their hours, but they may also have to raise prices. And if you're talking about the service industry and fast food, then it might disproportionately affect poor people. So in other words, raising wages becomes a kind of an arms race for poor people, and the earned income tax credit might be a better way to go rather than raise the minimum wage. Bill?
Sure. I'll make 2 points on that. First, as on the earned income tax credit, I think the current research that I'm looking at suggests that shouldn't be really an either or, that it could be actually better to use these two anti-poverty tools in concert. So if you just do the earned income tax credit, that's sort of an implicit wage subsidy. So it's going to get more people to enter the labor market that might not otherwise and potentially drive down wages, giving some of the benefit to low-wage employers. But if you couple that with a sort of a wage floor, then you're sort of targeting more of the benefits to low-income households. The second thing on price increases, I mean, this is kind of where the research is going now, is figuring out if we've sort of settled this employment effect, whether it's small or non-existent, well, what are the mechanisms of adjustment? And I already talked about turnover, which could be a significant one. All the other mechanism is raising prices. And what we've seen in some of the studies that have focused on this is that the price increases are moderate. So you think about a typical, say, restaurant. labor costs are about a third of the total cost of everything that goes into producing. So if you're increasing that third, it's not going to have – it could be one-to-one carried over into prices necessarily. The prices of all sorts of things that go into restaurant fluctuate all the time, and we don't see this. So what the research was done in San Francisco was when San Francisco had a citywide minimum wage, passed a minimum wage in 2004, there was a moderate price increase at restaurants of about 2.8%. So it's sort of – when you talk about a trade-off, is it better to really target a wage increase to these millions of poor families or poor households that would get it and accept a relatively modest price increase as a result? We're still figuring out what that exact price increase might be. But there are other mechanisms besides the turnover and besides the price that could also lead to an adjustment. So the other thing is higher productivity or getting sort of more work from the workers that you have, lower absentee costs, people deciding, I really value this job much more and I'm not going to just not show up and risk getting fired. So those are the kind of things that also help in terms of adjusting to a minimum wage increase.
When your lower turnover rate, I guess, points to that, but it doesn't quite prove that you're going to get higher productivity from the higher wage, right?
Right. There's been other studies. There's a study in Georgia and that looked at actually surveyed franchise owners and looked at ways that they tried to sort of get more work out of a given hour.
Jeffrey,
that's kind of where the research is going. It's not sort of finished yet.
Well, this question of productivity now is active in this debate. We've seen a great increase in business productivity. Wages, on the other hand, have remained relatively flat. They're no longer linked as they were before 1980. So shouldn't just as a question of kind of equity, aren't the people who make companies value and productive, shouldn't they be sharing in this productivity gain?
Well, they definitely should. But the reason that wages and productivity have delinked, as you mentioned, is because we're measuring them in the aggregate instead of for specific industries. So the fact is, when you look at productivity in the food service sector, which contains almost half of all minimum wage workers, it has been barely going up at all. It's been going up at an average of about 0.5% per year. So the fact that engineers at Google are raising productivity by so much that the national average of labor productivity has gone up a lot doesn't mean that fast food workers can get paid more money. The fact that bankers and doctors who can, radiologists can now read your x-rays digitally from at home in the middle of the night, that raises their productivity. But we can't pay fast food workers more because of that.
Well, and so productivity is a kind of abstract measure of this kind of cost of inputs versus the net profit. But if you look at profit overall, and I want to ask you this, Jeffrey, again, one of the complaints about raising the minimum wage at the executive level or from the congressional level is you're tampering with the market. Why is Congress telling us how to run our business and how to pay people? Look, if people are willing to work for $7, $8 an hour, then that should be the price of labor, right? We don't want government tampering with this price. On the other hand, if you look at, say, the stock price, not the productivity, but McDonald's, for instance, I just took a look, from 2007, before the crash, to today, the stock price has tripled for McDonald's, tripled, and yet wages haven't. For Marriott, up 20% over that same period, doubled for Walmart. So shouldn't there be some link between the value of a company? If we don't want government to do it, shouldn't there be some mechanism by which workers actually have the benefit of the productivity and the value that they put into the company? Jeffrey, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, two things. First, we need to remember that McDonald's does not own most McDonald's. So McDonald's is worth more money because all those franchise owners have to send McDonald's money every month. That doesn't mean they have more money to pay their workers. But
somebody's got more money if the value of the McDonald's corporation tripled, right?
People who own stock in McDonald's have more money.
Okay. Keep going.
But they don't necessarily own McDonald's. But then there is already a mechanism for solving the exact problem you mentioned. And it is, in fact, the exact thing that everybody accuses these businesses of, which is greed. If the people were really worth so much more money, then a competitor would offer them a raise to hire them away. So if McDonald's workers were so profitable, then somebody would open Wendy's nearby and hire their workers away and pay them a little bit more and steal their business. And the McDonald's would have to hire them back by paying a little more money. And eventually, the workers would end up with a fair share of their money through competition.
Bill?
Well, that implies a lot, a picture of the labor market that sort of is adjusting instantaneously. Well, sort of a more realistic picture is a labor market that involves a lot of frictions. It's difficult for that worker to find out about that better job, you know, 10 feet away, you know, because the jobs aren't 10 feet away. They're oftentimes in another neighborhood and you have to get on the bus. So there's, you know, real life slows this process down, and it sort of implies a model of the labor market that's more monopsonistic, not to use a technical term, but that involves a lot sort of information asymmetries that are really sort of difficult to make that process happen. But back to this point on productivity, I think it really saying that, you know, workers and productivity hasn't gone up in food services, so therefore they shouldn't get a raise, kind of implies sort of a flawed logic for wage setting throughout the service industry, where productivity is really difficult to measure, A, and unlikely to have the kinds of labor-saving gains that you can have, say, in high-tech manufacturing or even Google. Wage setting in this sector is really about social norms, and the minimum wage is sort of one way we can get this. The example, you know, that's often talked about in sort of economics is, well, you know, look at the case of orchestras. You know, in the 19th century, for an orchestra to play a Bach piece, it's had the same number of people in the orchestra as it does today. Does that mean they should never, ever have gotten a raise? No. Wages increase because productivity throughout the whole economy goes up, and they find a way to redistribute from one sector to another. But even if we look at productivity in the sign of sectors that employ low-wage workers, so I looked at the same data set from accommodation and food service as a whole, which includes hotels as well as restaurants, productivity between 1987 and 2011, where the data comes from, grew by 20%. If you track the real value of the minimum wage from 87 to 2011, it's only by 9%. So even in that sector, we do see some productivity improvements that there is sort of room to make that improvement. But generally speaking, the reason why people talk about the difference between the minimum wage and productivity is to really provide context about the way our economy as a whole is growing and who's benefiting from that. And the minimum wage is really kind of one of the only tools we have to allow workers to, at the low end, who have very little power in the labor market, to gain some of that productivity and increase throughout the whole economy.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Bill Lester, a professor of city and regional planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, currently visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. Jeffrey Dorfman's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Georgia. For more information, go to our website, stateofthings.org. This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.